Go to Acts chapter 25. Acts chapter 25. Remember back in chapter 21, Paul arrived at Jerusalem against almost everyone's advice, including Luke, that encouraged him not to go there. He went down, he made sort of an appeasing act toward the Jews, and from that point on you have a whole series of events, riots, trials before the Sanhedrin, trials before the Roman procurators, and so forth. And we've come now down to the fact that in Acts, Paul gives five defenses of his ministry. We are now down to number four, Paul's defense before Festus, and it is chapter 25, verses 1 through 12. And by way of introduction to this particular defense, we need to say several things. First of all, this is the briefest of Paul's defenses, and its content parallels the one we've just had. It parallels his defense before Felix. The new element, and that's very important, the new element that comes in to this event in chapter 25 triggers the entire rest of the book of Acts. Because in chapter 25, Paul says something brand new, and this determines the course of the rest of the book. Chapter 25 and verse 11. He says to Festus, "If then I'm a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar." So the new element is found in the words, "I appeal to Caesar, the emperor of the Roman Empire." And this appeal, and we'll see on what basis it could be made and so forth, this appeal determines the content of the rest of the book of Acts. It determines the direction of the rest of the book. Because the rest of the book, as soon as we get past his greatest defense, which is his defense before King Agrippa, with chapter 27, when it was decided that we should set sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And now in chapter 27 and 28, Paul goes from Jerusalem to the end, almost to the end, of the Roman Empire, or to Rome. And therefore this remark, "I appeal to Caesar," is very, very important. Now, let me give you with that, however, a little bit of background. This is unusual because if you're in a particular court and you're on trial, you can't simply say over your traffic ticket that you don't want to pay, "I appeal to the United States Supreme Court." Well, that's exactly what is had in this particular context. And so as far as background, let's put down several things. Every citizen of Rome had the right to appeal to Caesar. Every citizen had this right. Now, a good question, and it's one that Mark Dixon asked last time. He said, how in the world could Caesar hear everybody that appealed to him? Well, the answer is, first of all, they had that right. No question about that. However, there were certain conditions. So let's put down a few things about Roman law that will make it clear. The Roman law stated that everyone could appeal under certain conditions. The Roman law stated conditions under which this appeal could make. And let me give you a few terms here. In the Roman law of the time, which would be the Julio-Claudian period, you had what was called the Lexiulea. It was the law under which Paul was operating. The Lex Iulia provided, and I'll use the terms that they would have used, though probably not pronouncing them right because I do not know Latin, the lex ilia provided for what they called ad cesarum. And under this system of law, you're allowed to appeal to the Caesar under certain conditions. And the conditions were, number one, that appeal to Caesar could be made from a capital offense. In other words, if you were on trial for your life and you wish to appeal, you could do so. Capital offense. Now, there was a test in that. And the test, a capital offense from a provincial governor. For example, Festus was a provincial governor, a new one, that just succeeded Felix and comes onto the scene in Acts chapter 25. And therefore, a provincial ruler or governor, as he was, looked at his responsibilities in terms of keeping law and order and looked at the cases through these glasses. Is this case ordo? Or is this case extra ordinum? And these are things that had to be decided about Paul's case. Now, those two terms carried this meaning. We have what we talk about as jurisdiction. A certain court could try certain things. Certain things are out of their jurisdiction. For example, a capital offense would not be tried in municipal court. That's out of its jurisdiction. That's out of its sphere. Well, this is the same thing. If it was in the sphere of what the provincial governor could do, it was ordo. If it was out of that, it was extra ordinum. And while he could try these, a capital offense was extra ordinum. And therefore, when that criteria was met, the person involved could then appeal to that particular category. So first is capital offense. The second thing from which you could make an appeal was if you were under threat of coercion. In other words, if it could be established that you are being coerced, harassed into court, and of course Paul was with the Sanhedrin, then that would be legal grounds for making this appeal. Just a little subsequent history. In the second century, the provincial administrators like Festus or Felix had been automatically sent citizens to Rome for certain offenses. In the third century, appeal was allowed anyone within 2 or 3 days of a conviction in a province. And therefore, we have this as background, and these things will be working. The Romans operated under an excellent system of law. The only place you have chaos is in Jewish court. The place you have order and fairness and justice is in a Roman court. And who was it in the trials of Jesus that said, "I find no fault in this man"? Is that the Sanhedrin speaking? Is that the High Court of Israel? No way. That's the Roman court speaking. And that's why Paul appeals here, because there was a good degree of fairness as far as justice in these courts were concerned. Number four, let's put down the references in the rest of Acts to Paul's appeal. The first one obviously is here. I appeal to Caesar. That is strictly legal. That is taking advantage of the Roman legal system. So we have it here in chapter 25 and verse 11. If you continue on, it is mentioned in verse 21. And the way it is mentioned here is Festus, just into office as provincial governor, is visited by Bernice and Agrippa into his new office. And he tells Agrippa that he is absolutely perplexed over what to do with Paul. He's made an appeal to Rome. He had to write a report. And he doesn't even know what to report about. And thus you come to verse 21. He says, when Paul, this is Festus speaking to Agrippa, King Agrippa, when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar. The second mention of it. Verse 25 and 26. King Agrippa says, I found that he committing nothing worthy of death, and since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him, Festus speaking. Yet I have nothing definite about him to write to my lord. I don't know what to say. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that the investigation, after the investigation is taken, I may have something to write. In other words, he's got to obey the law, he's got to send Paul to Caesar, and he's got to send a letter along saying, what is the state of the case? And he says, frankly, I don't know what the state of the case is. I don't know what the man has done. And you can see the bind he is in. He's newly appointed. He's just in office over the province, and he's got a man that's appealed to Caesar. By law, he's got to send him to Caesar, but Caesar is expecting a letter, a report. What is the state of the case? He can't just say, well, my lord, the emperor, I send you Paul. I have no idea what he's done. That would obviously bring down his wrath. So he is going to be in a bind, and we'll find out how he handles that. Also, chapter 25 and 26 mentioned. Also, in chapter 26, verse 32, this becomes very much a underlying idea throughout here, 26 and verse 32. Agrippa said to Festus, this man might have been set free if he hadn't appealed to Caesar. So you can see the binding nature of this thing and why they have to do it. And then finally, in chapter 28 and verse 19. As he speaks, he says, when the Jews objected, I was forced to appeal to Caesar. So notice this is going to be pretty much a theme. He's taken advantage of the provisions of the Roman law, and he is going to go to Caesar and thus to Rome. Fifth. Now there's something at first glance that's strange about this. Why would Paul prefer the emperor to Festus? You say, well, higher authority. But stop and think for a minute. You know who was emperor between 54 and 68 A.D.? Paul made this appeal about 60 A.D. You know who the emperor was, don't you? His name was Nero. And you know some things about Nero, do you not? And therefore, some back off and say, well, why in the world would this man who burnt Rome and blamed Christians and used their very bodies to make a flame to light his garden, why in the world would a man like Paul want to appeal to him? And the answer to that is simply this, that there were two distinct phases in the reign of Nero. The first 9 years, he was under the influence of a Stoic philosopher named Seneca. And Seneca was a benevolent man, a Stoic, and he was influenced strongly, this man Nero. However, the last 5 years of Nero are quite different. The last, in fact, some of the historians, such as your Josephus, Tacitus, will use this. They will, I forget which one it is, or I would tell you, but I remember reading, they call this, as far as Christians were concerned under Nero, a golden age for those first 9 years when they were in relative peace. However, the last five were a complete turnaround, and the last 5 years were radically different from the first, and it was simply violent hatred of Christians. Now, that being the case then, if he reigned from 54 to 68, and Paul appealed in the year 60, which is pretty firm date, we were 6 years into golden age. And some of the later hatred that's going to emerge in the latter part of Nero's reign had not come yet, and therefore Paul makes his appeal to the emperor. All right, now let's go to chapter 25. And we can break the first 12 verses into two parts. Number one, Festus visits Jerusalem. chapter 25, 1 through 5. And the next part, notice if you're looking at chapter 25, notice that if you have American Standard Bible, you notice that your paragraph extends from 1 to 5, and the second paragraph from 6 to 12. And they all have to do with Paul before Festus. However, 1 through 5 is Festus visits Jerusalem. 6 through 12 is Festus returns to Caesarea. So first, Festus visits Jerusalem. First of all, a little about his identity. We know that he was the successor of Felix. And if there's any contrast between these two men and their personal habits, Felix was a procrastinator. Festus was prompt. And we'll see that contrast, I think, working out. Now, the reason we know that Felix was so much of a procrastinator is that Paul had been brought before him. And the lawyer Tertullus, along with the Sanhedrin, goes up to Caesarea where Paul is in protective custody. Tertullus argues two points. Number one, he's guilty of sedition against the Roman Empire. Number two, he's guilty of profaning the temple by bringing a Gentile into it. And the interesting thing about that is that considers two totally different systems of law. The first one, sedition, that was Roman law. The second, which is profaning the temple, was Jewish law. The thing they have in common is they were both capital offenses. Sedition, capital offense. And we have record of Felix crucifying in Judea many who practiced sedition. And so it was sort of a double charge under two sets of laws, both of which would have drawn a capital offense were they carried out. Well, Felix procrastinates. And notice as we come to the end of chapter 24, he is put in jail to wait. And after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. So Felix delayed a decision on Paul for 2 years. He's a procrastinator. He didn't wish to decide. He delayed a decision for 2 years. Now, can we get involved with Paul a minute and try to explain? Can we feel with Paul? How would you like to be in jail for 2 years while the judge dilly-dallied about what to do with you? That was Paul. And especially, how would you feel if you know you're absolutely innocent of all charges? And I've just been left here for 2 years. It was an excellent opportunity, and we certainly feel with Paul, but this was an excellent opportunity to develop a virtue that is extolled many times in the New Testament. Do you remember? We've been over it. An opportunity for Paul to develop what he taught himself, hupomone. Remember that word? Which means load-carrying capacity. Load-carrying ability. It's the word that is translated perseverance. It's a word for patience, and it doesn't mean you just grin and bear it. It means under this you learn to carry a load. We've given the illustration out of the papyri, how a man advertised a donkey that he had for sale, and this donkey is hupomone. That means the beast isn't broken down on the back. This animal can still carry a load. And Paul takes that in many passages in the New Testament. Romans 5, don't you know that pressure and tests develop perseverance or load-carrying ability. And therefore, 2 years, unjust, the judge can't make up his mind, and you just sit there and rot. Paul learned load-carrying ability in those particular circumstances. But I think there's a second lesson involved in it. After 2 years, what do you think would have happened to the Jewish hostility and hatred toward Paul? Wouldn't you think after 2 years it would have cooled? It didn't. They hated him so bad that even after 2 years, when he's released, they want him. So this shows the intense hatred of the Jews for Paul. He wasn't even in Jerusalem to bother them. He was up at Caesarea in jail under Roman custody. He wasn't bothering them in Jerusalem. But they hated him so bad that even after 2 years, they have not cooled in any sense of the word in their attitude toward Paul. Now, if you were the new procurator, and that's the end of chapter 24, if you were Festus and you were to govern Judea and you were to manage and rule Israel, what would be the first step you would probably take? First step you would take is, I need to go down and I need to meet the Jewish leadership. I'm going to be ruling them as procurator, and therefore I need to meet them. And therefore, verse 1 of chapter 25 makes sense. Festus, therefore, keep in mind now, Felix is off the scene and Paul is still in jail and he's just forgotten about him, I guess. So chapter 25, Festus, therefore, having his new office, arrived in the province. 3 days later, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him and so forth and so forth. So notice the first thing coming up is he obviously goes to make the journey to meet the leaders of the people he is to govern. By the way, at that time, we need to scratch out one man. Remember when he was arrested and taken up to Caesarea, the high priest at that time was Ananias. Under Felix, the high priest was Ananias, who hated Paul so badly, takes Tertullus the lawyer to try to get the death sentence for Paul. When Felix went out, Festus went in, and just a matter of a short few weeks before Festus went in, Ananias went out, and a new high priest is brought into the picture, and his name was Ishmael. So the Roman ruler is changed, the high priest is changed, and therefore obviously passed on to him is, and his fellow leaders in the Sanhedrin, was this deep, deep hatred for Paul. Now, what is the train of thought? And let's read verses 2 and 3 and see if we can trace the train of thought that the Jews had. The chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him, requesting a concession against Paul. They might have him brought to Jerusalem, at the same time setting an ambush to kill him on the way. So they're thinking, let's just put it down as the pattern of thought on the part of the Jews is this, and I think you can feel it coming through the context. In the first place, they obviously were counting on Festus' lack of experience. He was a novice. One of the things that Paul notes about Felix is, you certainly understand Jewish matters. When he goes before Agrippa, he's going to understand, you, Agrippa, understand Jewish matters, and therefore I'm glad to be before you. Felix, for example, had ruled over the Jews for about 8 years before he was retired. This man is brand new. He's just arrived in the province. He has no experience in dealing with the Jews, and that of all jobs, to be ruler, Roman ruler, or procurator in the province where Jerusalem was, had to be a real pain. They were forever having to put down Jewish uprising, Jewish complaints, and so forth. And therefore, it took a great deal of experience. Jews were very clever about, basically, the one that ruled Jerusalem and Judea lived up at Caesarea because he couldn't stand the Jews. He just couldn't tolerate their antics that were continually going on, and therefore Caesar had a palace up at Caesarea, up to the northwest on the coast of the Mediterranean away from Jerusalem, but he nonetheless ruled it. And therefore, the Jews at Jerusalem were forever finagling, they were forever maneuvering, and here's a man that has just come on the scene, he's just arrived at his new post in the province of Caesarea, he's green, he's naive, we can count on that, and they certainly were. Second, their thought was this: if we can get him transferred, from Caesarea back to Jerusalem, then this gives us, as he comes down the road, a chance for ambush. We can kill him on the way. And their thought would be then two things. Our two chances to kill Paul are, number one, kill him on the road. Number two, bring him down to Jerusalem, get a change in venue, and in the change in venue, we will convict him of capital offense under our law. Now, it's very possible when verse 3 says they want to kill him on the way, we do have a hint of who that might be. If you go back to chapter 23, 12 and 13, remember there was a group of Jews that had taken a vow they would not eat or drink until they killed Paul? And when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. And there were more than 40 who formed this plot. Now, while the text does not say so, it's hard to believe that this group that was going to ambush him coming out of Caesarea is probably the same 40, isn't it? May have joined to their ranks. But this shows the intensity of how badly they want to prove deal with Paul. Another line of thinking that must have been in their mind is, if we can get him to Jerusalem, then the sedition charge can be dropped and we can go on profaning the temple. And I would think by this time they were pretty anxious to drop the sedition charge, because they've been before Felix, and Felix, as far as sedition was concerned, would hang like that. And they brought him before Felix, and Felix saw nothing seditious about Paul. So they could not prove it in court. Sedition meant nothing before the Sanhedrin. So this thing we've been trying to prove, we can't prove. We can't even get a trumped-up charge on it. It doesn't work. We've been in Roman court. We lost in Roman court. And now we can bring him down to Jerusalem, forget all about the sedition, and we can go to profaning the temple. And it will uncomplicate things. And if we can prove and accuse him and prove that he profaned the temple, then almost always, even the Jews couldn't practice capital punishment themselves, almost always, almost without exception, according to the histories, whenever someone had profaned the temple, gone before the past the court of the Gentiles, into the court of the men or the court of the Jewish males, it was a death penalty, and Rome almost always upheld it. In fact, I know of no exceptions where they did not uphold that sentence if it was passed by the Jewish senator. They inevitably said, all right, you can take his life. So they probably have this kind of thinking with Paul and are going to execute these plans. Now, if in verse 4 and 5, Festus is going to unknowingly upset their plans, and his line of thinking is going to be simply this: hey, Paul is already in our custody. I'm going to go back to Caesarea real soon. Why bother to bring him out of Caesarea down here? And of course, that defeated their purpose. So notice verse 4. Festus then answered that Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea, and that he himself was about to leave shortly. Therefore, in the light of those facts, how about doing this? Let the influential men among you go there with me, and if there's anything wrong about the man, let them prosecute him. Now, this gives a little insight into this man Festus that contrasts the Jewish high court. Number one, his proposal denotes three things. Number one, it denotes orderly procedure. It denotes orderly procedure. And the orderly procedure is, we have him in custody, I'm about to leave, you come up there, if there's anything wrong about the man, we will prosecute him. orderly procedure. Contrast the Sanhedrin, what were they always doing? Slap him on the face. They threw dust into the air. They tore their clothes. Same thing with the trials of Jesus. Absolutely chaos. Absolute order as far as the Roman court is concerned. The second thing that it denotes is it denotes a fair investigation. And I think you can see that there in the words of verse 4. If there's anything wrong. And what is he saying? He says, I do not know. I'm not coming to conclusions, but we will bring it in an orderly way into court, and there will be an investigation to see if this is true. Obviously, the other thing that is denoted is it denotes legal procedure. We will file charges if they need to be filed. We will make accusations if needs be. Now, I think that gives a little more, does it not, about why was Paul anxious to get into Roman court? Why did he want to go to Caesar? Because he probably would get a fair trial before Caesar because of the nature of these things. All right, he goes now to Jerusalem, and now we have Festus returns to Caesarea. Goes to Jerusalem, 1 through 5, and now he returns to Caesarea, verses 6 through 12. And the first six verses we will call the court convenes. Court convenes. 6 through 8. Verse 6. After he, Festus, had spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea, and on the next day took his seat on the tribunal, ordered Paul to be brought. This is a very orderly man, a very disciplined man, a man that was prompt about his responsibilities, and that is pictured here in this thing. So notice, after 2 years, the case against Paul is opened again. It's before a new judge, and it's after a 2-year lapse. In the light of total of evidence, notice verse 7, after he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bring many serious charges against him, which they could not prove. And therefore, if the charges could not be proved, all Paul is going to have to do is simply respond by denying the charges. There's no proof. So Paul comes along then and denies the charges, which is in verse 8, while Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple, or against Caesar. And the reason he didn't have to argue it is very simple. They hadn't proved anything. And having proved nothing, all Paul has to say is the charges are not so. And he does so. And then a dialogue develops. Festus, being new in this office, obviously doesn't want to get the people he has to rule against him. So the words of verse 9, Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? In other words, all he is saying, I will be the judge, but would you accept a change of venue? Would you be willing to do this at Jerusalem rather than to do it at Caesarea? And that does not suit Paul for several reasons. Simply indicates that Paul does not see this as an innocuous change of location. And I think Paul's thinking is probably something like this. Return to Jerusalem is going to put me in jeopardy all over again. If the Sanhedrin made a concession here to the Jews, what might they also do when you get to Jerusalem? Isn't he likely maybe to make another concession? That's probably part of Paul's thinking. And then third, Felix had been experienced. Festus was not. And so Paul objects. He comes down to his last resort, the only thing that is left for him to do, which he does in verse 11. If then, he's speaking to Festus, I am a wrongdoer, have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of these things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them and exercise his right. I appeal to Caesar. Now, since it was capital offense, Festus has no choice. He's got to do it. Well, if that is the case, then what does verse 12 mean? Then when Festus had conferred with his council, he answered, "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go." Well, the decision that he had to make there was not whether he should be sent to Caesar, but the reason he adjourns to make the decision is, number one, he had to answer, are these charges — this was basically his first act as a new provincial governor — are these charges ordo, or are they extra ordinum? In other words, does this lie within my jurisdiction? He had to ask that. And obviously the answer, since it involved capital punishment on two counts under Jewish and Roman law, obviously the answer was, this is extra ordinum. Extra ordinum means it's out of my jurisdiction. I cannot try that case. He did have one other option. What the other option might be, and he had it. He could have done it like that. He could have acquitted Paul. He might have discussed that with his cabinet. I don't know. He could have acquitted. And released Paul on the spot. Felix's decision, therefore, that he would not acquit him was not a was something he'd have done legally. But at this point, if he had done that with the virulent Jewish hatred, it would have been political suicide. And he knew that if I'm to rule these people, I don't start out acquitting what their high court considers to be the nation's greatest enemy. You just don't do that. It's impolitic. And therefore, he does not do that and faces his next problem. And his next problem is, what kind of letter am I going to write when I don't even know? Here I am, my provincial, my first case. And I've got to write a report of what the problem is, and I don't even know what the problem is. He had, up to this point, the Roman authorities had investigated the Sanhedrin, they'd asked the Jewish people, they had asked Paul, and they couldn't decide what in the world was this big temple riot where they about tore Paul to pieces. What was it all about? And they had to decide that. So let's close out tonight with just a few notes on transition to Paul's greatest defense. Transition to Paul's greatest defense. First of all, the defense is going to be before King Agrippa. It's recorded in Acts 25:23-26:32. Now, the thing that makes this such a great defense is this. It doesn't center, and notice it's rather long, but it doesn't center on the charges made by the Jews. Paul's defense is really a great evangelistic effort, where he is going to end up speaking to the judge and saying, Agrippa, I want you and every Gentile to become a Christian and become like me, except for these chains. And it's going to become a very, very telling defense. So the focus then is on two things. It is on Paul himself, and it is on the gospel. It's almost as though Paul is saying, my freedom is not the issue, your salvation is. The thing I long for is to fulfill my commission, which is go to the Gentiles, and I'm in a Gentile court, and I want you Romans to be saved. I want you to come to know the Christ that I know. And Paul gets so involved in that message that he almost forgets, as someone put it, the defense of Paul before Agrippa was the defense where Paul forgot to defend himself. And becomes so involved
in the message of the gospel and his mission with that message. Now let's just follow through in our text and see that focus reading, and we'll be handling it in our next study or at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Okay, so chapter 26, verse 4. Notice the focus on himself. He's not defending himself against the charges of the Jews at all. 26, verse 4. So then, all Jews know my manner of life from my youth up, which was from the beginning spent among my own nation at Jerusalem, since they have known about me for a long time previously, if they're willing to testify that I lived as a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of the religion. Verse 9 through 15. So then, I thought to myself I had to do many things hostile to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. That continues down through verse 15. Verse 19. Consequently, King Agrippa, I did not prove disobedient to the heavenly vision. Focus on the gospel. 26:6. And now I'm standing trial for the hope of the promise made to our fathers, a promise to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day. And for this hope, O King, I'm being accused by the Jews. And the great hope, of course, was the hope of the Messiah and the Savior. Verse 18, he has been commissioned. And notice, he's not dealing with his defense, but he said, I've been commissioned to open their eyes, Gentile eyes, so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the dominion of Satan to God, in order that they might receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among those that have been sanctified by faith in me. Verse 22. And so, having obtained help from God, I stand to this day, testifying both to small and great, stating nothing but what the prophets and Moses are going to take place, that the Christ was to suffer, and that by reason of his resurrection from the dead, he should be the first proclaimed light both to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. And then finally, in verse 29, Agrippa said, he's on trial. And Agrippa finally says, you think in this trial you're going to make me become a Christian? And Paul says in verse 29, I would to God that whether in a short time or a long time, not only you, but all who hear me this day, might become such as I am, except for these chains. And so notice the totally selfless thing on the part of Paul is his desire for their salvation. And this is the scene that we have in front of us. Now, next time we'll pick up with the struggle that Festus is going to have is, how in the world am I going to write this letter to the Caesar? What am I going to say? And he will get some advice from Agrippa, and then we will get into his magnificent defense that comes in this latter part of the book of Romans. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word, for Paul's courage. We are so immune from the type of persecution that Paul experienced, we can hardly identify. Recognizing that if Paul should stand in front of us tonight, there would be a gash in his arm. There would be scars on his face. Hardly could a man get stoned and left for dead without lifelong marks in his body. And then he boasts of these marks in writing the Galatian church, saying that I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. And we're thankful for his faithfulness to the truth. May we emulate him in Christ's name. Amen.